The Gospel of John, chapter 6. After these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, and a great multitude followed him, because they saw his miracles which he did on them that were diseased. Jesus went up into a mountain, and there he sat with his disciples. And the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was nigh. When Jesus then lifted up his eyes, saw a great company come unto him, he saith unto Philip, when I used to preach on Easter Sunday, now I seldom have the time, as I have tried to cut the message into some reasonable time level, but one of the proofs of the honesty of the reporters, I remember as I preach each year on the evidence of our faith in the resurrection of Christ, any actual exposure to the facts in and around the early message drive you to the conclusion that either the disciples were lying and knew that they were lying, or they were honest reporters of events they experienced. One of the proofs of their honesty is the indirect evidences of honesty in their record, because these gospel writers wrote in different places at different times about the same or similar events. And this is one of the little intrinsic, inside, indirect proofs of their honesty. You have to go to three different Gospels to get the story. You go to one Gospel and you find out that Philip was of Bethsaida. That was the territory where he lived. And Jesus called him from that area. You go to another gospel to find out that this is occurring in the area in and around Bethsaida. And you go to this gospel to find out that it's Philip that Jesus is going to ask where to buy bread. These are little subtle things, but when you have Matthew writing probably up in Antioch, John probably writing at Ephesus, Matthew possibly at Antioch also, but not certain. But that's my choice, to correct the statement that he did it at Antioch. There's some debate about it, but I think he did. Luke, somewhere totally different, and Mark writing either at Rome or more likely at Alexandria, distant from one another, telling the same event, and you have to get all three of them to piece it together, but it hangs together. Philip was called from the Bethsaida area. They're in the Bethsaida area. Philip is the one the question's asked to. But with that little historic parenthesis and proof of integrity, then you come to the point of the message. Jesus lifted up his eyes, saw a great company come unto him. Another record has it 5,000, and another record has it 5,000 men, not counting the women and children, which is probably the accurate one, which means you're going to have more like 12,000 with wives and children. He saw a great company, is all John says. At this point, he'll number later. Come unto him, and he saith unto Philip, when shall we buy bread that these may eat? Now this method continues the giving series. When shall we buy bread that these may eat? And the sixth verse says, this he said to prove him, for he himself knew what he would do. He himself knew. Socrates perfected the method years ago of teaching by rhetorical questions. This wasn't a rhetorical question, but it is, again, a question by the teacher designed to test the knowledge of the student, not to give the student opportunity to instruct the teacher by answering a question that the poor fool didn't know the answer to. I won't dwell on this a while until I get everybody in the same room with me. It's like an employee arrives 2 days late. Do you know what time it is? I believe it's 12:15, sir. The awfulest urge then whelms me to hit them so hard that they couldn't sneeze if they were sitting down. They're not all here with me yet. I used to teach missionaries that were going to South America to understand the way in which we are creatures of our language and how difficult it is for the Latin mind, and they'll get mad at me, you folks. I didn't produce your language. But how difficult it is for the Latin mind to instantly respond with, I blew it, I'm sorry, I messed up, I did it. Nobody else, me, I did it. Because from the smallest child up, their language conditions them to shift the blame. The way the language structure is, they drop a piece of china and it breaks. Their language is designed to say, oh, look, it broke itself. You're getting there, but not yet. And I wish some of you people would quit looking at me with tunnel vision and trying to stamp your image on this church. This church may be the most truly pluralistic church in the world. Every age level, every cultural frame, every racial frame, and every spiritual frame, from Muslims to Christian Science to Catholics to Arabs to Jews. And I have to play this keyboard to bring all the minds to the same place so I can move on. Add to it the television. There are some people in this congregation who only wake up to graphic language. And some of you are so sensitive that, as Bill Cosby says, to find that the Lord adds odor to poo-poo after 4 months along the baby's trip so offends you to even describe it that delicately. I thought Cosby did it very well. So, you know, I'll cover the ground. You just apply the parts that fit your delicate ears. But let me bring us all to the same place. It's so hard for us to accept the fact really, it's very hard for most of us to come to grips with the reality that in relationship to God, and lots of times relationship to man, but particularly in relationship to God, we're just a bunch of assholes. And there ain't no other word in the English language that can say so much with so little verbal effort. Oh, they'll bleep that out when we play it for the delicate ears of non-satellite viewers. You got that marked, haven't you? Yeah. Yeah, mark that. I do not want to leave this verse until you understand the degree of Philip that's in any of us, and all of us. If there's any one thing wrong with this church, too many of us are just like Philip. And some of you who heard my dabbling in this on festival think you know it all already, so you're probably wondering with your mind somewhere else. I've only started on this subject. God gave me a revelation. He gave me a revelation as I was reading this the other night, bored with you because you weren't calling. Philip! He saith unto Philip, which shall we buy bread that these may eat? He's asking me. Now's my chance to show off. Finally, I've got his attention. God seeking my advice. I never thought the opportunity would come to set things straight, but I got it now. Come a little closer, fellas. Come a little closer, gals. I want my answer heard. I've been waiting for this chance for 40 years. God finally recognizes he needs my help. Where, Philip? Where can we go buy some bread for this 12,000 strong mob out here? You lived in this area. You know, when you think about it, Jesus really set him up. He really set him up. I mean, you know, if he'd asked somebody just arriving from Alexandria, Egypt, the guy would, how would I know? At least his own ignorance would cause him to escape. But Philip, of course, the guy you'd expect to know where to buy bread, because he lived in the place the whole life, like, you know. Where do you get bad food in Glendale? Don't ask Bob Shuler's congregation, ask mine. Where is the fastest place to get heartburn in Glendale? You're experts.
12,000 people out there. Philip, where do we go to buy bread for these people? Am I boring you? This he said to prove him, for he himself knew what he would do. That thought never occurred to Philip. He just trucking along. He just following Jesus, you know, his mind somewhere else. But... Huh? Where to buy bread? Oh, yeah. He wants to know where to buy. It never dawned on Peter that the question was testing him about spiritual things. He still lived in the flesh. I mean, the only thing he had dedicated was the direction of his feet. The rest of his body was elsewhere. His head was somewhere else. I deal with them all the time. Well, they show up. They show up to work. I know about this, but I have people buy bread for my house. My mother and dad live there. Get money and we'll keep bread in the kitchen. Real complicated job. Real complicated job. How come there's no bread this morning? Well, I thought somebody was going to do it. How come there's no bread? Well, it's at the store. I mean, you know, the question is, how come there's no bread? Because I'm an irresponsible, addlepated asteroid orifice that saw the gate at quitting time and decided that it was the most important thing in life for me to be the first one out the gate. I lost my concern for a job well done, and I lost my sense of responsibility. You can finish it. How many times have I got on the phone, on the television and said, you missed your cues, folks? How many of you have ever applied a thing like this when I look into that camera and say, why aren't you calling? Now, what does that mean? That means that we've been over this ground 1,000 times, that every king's house is supposed to make a commitment that one night, at least one night a week, is your work night. Is that new? How many ever heard that before? Nobody's responsibility is exactly that. I get tired of having to explain when I'm chewing out those people that have become derelict in an agreement they've made with their pastor. I get tired of having to explain to the sensitive feelings of those that have done the job. If you aren't smart enough to figure out if you've done the job and thus I'm not talking to you, why should I have to keep explaining to you? I've said ever since I've been here, most of the time when I preach, I'm preaching to myself. Isn't that what I say? How many heard me say that? But by the same token, there ain't no false humility about this. I know when I'm not the target. I don't have to feel guilty that I'm bawling myself out for not getting on the telephone when I'm sitting there. Likewise, I'm getting tired of having to explain. It goes with the territory when you're a king's house. You dedicate one night a week to being the instrument of faith. You set that night aside. You come home exactly as if you were on some important committee that you had to go work at. Or if you're in the National Guard, somewhat of a passe ancient history thing, when you had to go commit yourself a night. You set it aside the way Ed Masry sets aside a night in the middle of the week when he's meeting some clients after hours. You have made a commitment to God, your pastor, and yourself. You work that night whether I ask you to or not. And work is not one call. You become as Atlas holding up the world. You're on that phone giving faith every minute. Don't tell me you're so stupid you don't know what that means. I'm just tired of commitments made that aren't kept. And when I'm chewing people out for not being on the phone, we have enough king's houses and king's tithers to keep every phone we've got busy all night long. If only 100 people treat that night as a work night. Work night means you try to talk to every single voice of faith that's on the phones that night. I also believe every king's house in this area should be a voice of faith, if only once a month. The point I'm making about Philip when I say, why aren't you on the telephone? The message is to those that that night is their commitment night. If only those that are committed to Monday night is their work night, when they're going to sit down in front of that camera and they're going to, or television, and they're going to get their snacks or whatever they get, and they're going to stay there until I shut it off. You're on duty. Have any of you heard me say this before? So when I'm roaring into the telephone, what usually happens? If it's Monday night and I'm roaring into the telephone, the one that has Friday night committed as their work night is probably the first one to call up and apologize because they're not working on Monday night too. And that makes me mad. I have a twin reaction. I respect the dedication because that's the way it always is. The few do so much. But it also indicates that they haven't caught the fact that I am not asking everybody to be every night on the telephone 7 days a week. I'm asking you to pick a night and be responsible. That's why I'm instilling the habit pattern of give something every week. I'm tired of the sporadic nature of this congregation. You pay your tithe when you get them. You call and commit something if it's only $1 every week. The entire church denominations have been built on less scriptural authority than I have for what I'm doing right now. Let each of you on the first day of the week lay in store. 1 Corinthians 16. Right after the foundation message of our faith on the resurrection. I want habits. I'm mad and tired, and if you got embarrassed last week, as some of you did, then you better listen close this morning. I'm getting mad at old-time king's houses, 400, 500, 300, even 2,000 when we're 50,250 now. Calling up on Thursday saying, this is my first call. I'm going to send in $200 Sunday. I want to take that $200 and shove it at you.
You insult me. This is not a game we play. Neither is it a fundraising trick. We are not doing this to get the money. I've told you honestly, we don't need $300,000. It's time to say what 14 years of teaching has accomplished. You spend as many years trying to train paralegals in your office as I've spent trying to train these para-Christians. You ought to fire them all 50 times if you hadn't killed them. I'm not on a popularity contest. God gave me to this church as the shepherd, and the shepherd carries a staff and whacks your ass when you get out of line. You're out of line. The very faithlessness you give your pastor is the faithlessness that will keep you out of heaven. I don't monitor your behavior, but I monitor your faith commitments. Your righteousness will take you nowhere. God will give you His righteousness for faithfulness. Forever lament being born in this century. I wish I'd been born in the day when a man's word was worth more than a piece of paper. When a handshake could settle a war. So when I asked the question, back to Philip, why aren't you on the telephone? The answer is because I'm a derelict, faithless, undependable rat that needs the mercy of God and the mercy of my pastor, and give me another chance. I don't need, well, you know, the roast was burning or my car broke down. Well, the kids just got in a fight because one of them was touching the other one. Or some other lame brain excuse to yourself. God, give me a people. But all you got to do is say something and all the lights go on. Jesus said it. He knew what He was going to do. Why don't you come home to you? Oh, you got all kinds of messes in your life. Whew! Awful. You come to church, and the Spirit of God makes you listen to the message. And the question of God's Spirit comes to you, why don't you have faith to believe God in miracles? Amen. Back to Gideon now. The Lord is with you, the one mighty in valor. Well, if the Lord be with me, then why is all this and wherewith, and I'm the poorest and the last, and ain't it miserable? Philip, where can we go buy bread for these people? This he said to prove him, for he himself knew what he would do. Now look at the opportunity that was given Philip. He could have said, buy bread. You're greater than Moses. And Moses, by his connection with God, brought manna from heaven every day to feed 3.5 million people. This is a peanut job for you. Or he could have said, Elijah, turn one meal into a provision indefinite. And you're greater than Elijah, because Moses and Elijah both ministered to you on that mountain. You have a much bigger task. say, well, he didn't know about the mountain yet. He knew about Jesus.
Oh! What's new, Lord? I know why you've led us out here. You're the same God that Deuteronomy says led his people into the wilderness and made them hunger, that he might prove them there and teach them that man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. You spoke and the worlds were formed. All you've got to do is say the word, Lord. And their hunger disappears.
Even the centurion came and surprised Jesus with his faith, saying, you don't have to come to my home. I'm a man with authority. I speak and those under me move.
All you got to do, say, Lord, is say, speak the word and she'll be all right. And Jesus said, not in all Israel have I seen faith like this.
What is this Christianity? It's just another church full of form that people come to on Sunday? Or have we been called out to demonstrate faith that starts with the resurrection and believes that Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever? Jesus led him out there to prove him. He asked Philip the question to prove him. For he himself knew what he would do. That is what Jesus would do. He knew what he's going to do. He just wanted to see if Philip had enough faith to anticipate it. And what does Philip do? I said earlier, I got too many Philips in this congregation. What's Philip do? Just read it. Not to make you puke. It's so much like all of us. You just want to go to the mirror when you get home and hit it. Listen to this. And here, I want you to know, on those other remarks, I wasn't preaching to me, I was preaching to you. At this point, I join you. I'm preaching to me as well as you. But by cracky, you ain't going to leave yourself out while I take my portion. What's Philip do? Oh, he's asking me, where can we go buy bread? Well, he knew where bread could be bought because he lived there. That wasn't his problem. He knew where the 7-Eleven was of Bethsaida or Vaughn's Market. Or maybe it was Obadiah's Vegetable Corral. Philip answered him, get ready for the big revelation, folks. 200 penny worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may take a little. Jesus didn't know how to count. Just think of that. Here's Peter, and here's Jesus. There's 12,000 people out there. And he turns to Philip and says, where can we buy bread for these people? Now, it's one of two things. Jesus has either gone blind or he can't count. I warn you. You better get inside this situation. Where do we buy bread, Philip, for these people? Hell, man. Can you see, Jesus, I hate that my answer is going to embarrass you. Didn't you see him sort of rolling his eyes at the other disciples? Do I dare say this? He's had a temporary lapse. Jesus gapped out. You know, he's under strain. Jesus, 200 penny worth.
couldn't buy enough bread to feed all of these if you only gave them one bite apiece.
I feel like sometimes my staff members, they come in and say, now they give me a list of things that came in the mail to pay. $242,000. And they bring me the count from the mail today. $17,000. And I say, how will you pay How am I going to pay $242,000 with $17,000 or $11,000? They'll look at me, pick up the adding machine,
the response I'm looking for is, let's pray. Just a little channel of faith somewhere. He asked him to prove him, for Jesus knew what he would do. And Philip could have gone down in history, immortalized forever, by simply exhibiting faith and tuning in to the opportunity. But he covered himself. I mean, just in case, when Jesus gets done with these stupid questions, he comes to the knowledge of what we said all along. Send these people away. He can't say, I didn't tell him. My asteroid's covered. I saw things as they were.
Remember the old board member in Orville used to live out there on the curve? In that old house, you saw him going. You were a deacon before God got you all the way in the ministry. Remember the old board member of that church in Orville? You saw him, and he was on his way to a business meeting. And he said to you, I don't know what they're voting on, but I'm against it. You remember that? Who? Herper, old brother Herper. Just there. Here goes Pastor Jesus again. Can't count and can't see. Asking us to do something that any man in his sane mind that can either count or see knows can't be done. And notice, he counts pennies. 200 pennies. Couldn't buy it. And oh, how the audience grabs it, because you read it in another passage. The rest of the disciples buy his answer. We couldn't take 200 penny worth and go around and get enough bread, they say in another passage. Oh, how doubt spreads. Man of faith, he can only get one or two that'll get up and say, yeah, I'm going to go, like Gideon's dad stands up and goes with it. Boy, you let a moaning groaner get a chance to air his point of view. He's right. 200 penny worth. 200 penny worth. Tell him over there. 200 penny worth. There ain't enough. 200 penny worth won't do it. I mean, you know, we haven't been able to make $1 million a month without a marathon.
That comes out to $272,000 a week. We've never, in 3 years, we haven't made $1 million without having to go through a marathon, hell, and grind ourselves down, beat on one another. And this fool pastor is now asking for $300,000 a week before he teaches. I mean, the least he could do is ask for $272,000. That's been the goal, hasn't it? Well, roughly really 4.2. But you divide 4 into a million, it comes out about $272,000. Isn't it? Nothing can come out. It's even less than that, isn't it? See, I caught you. There you go. You're all counting on me. I really faked that recovery. See how quick you lose the audience and faith when you start counting? I'll bet you that there's a woman or two or a man or two who's got a calculator under their coattail or something else figuring this out right now. Writing it. Some of you got something. You have back there. I got you. What is it? 230. Well, what a fool this pastor is. Now we've never been able to make 230 a week and he's asking for 300 a week. I told you we didn't need it, didn't I? Ground pennies. Fill of Anthony. 200 penny worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may take a little. And one of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, saith unto him, there's a lad here. You know, Andrew is Peter Marshall, late chaplain of the U.S. Senate, has preached a message on Andrew, whose outstanding characteristic was always bringing somebody to Christ. Andrew, he's bringing this lad. Andrew, there's a lad here which hath 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes. How many of you have seen Philip in your nature, that when the opportunity to be a participant in a miracle happening occurs, you start counting print pennies and looking at circumstance? Let me see your hand. Well, you see, God told on Philip. Well, what do you think is going to happen at the judgment? Assume you make it in. If your little faith can be kept alive enough to get in, and you miss the white throne judgment where Jesus stood in for us and took the wrath of God, and no Christian will be at the white throne judgment because everybody there will be judged falling short of God's standard and judged according to their works and cast into the lake of fire. We don't go there. But after everything else is finished in the prophetic pattern of time, there is the judgment seat of Christ, where the relative rewards in heaven that take us past the skin of the teeth entrance and determine our position throughout the eons of eternity. No question we're in. What's the reward? And what's going to be our status throughout eternity is determined at the judgment seat of Christ. And that's when we'll be told on again. Every one of these events give us that opportunity to be a Philip who counts pennies and looks at circumstance and filters God's promises through the reality of time and fail the test of the proving that Jesus, who will be the judge at the white throne, not at the white throne judgment, he stands in for us, but we'll be at the judgment seat of Christ, the Bema judgment. A chance was given Philip to not underestimate Christ, to
to have faith. He counted pennies and had realistic sight. Now, Andrew, he's got a little more. He's got a little more faith. He brings the lad with the basket of loaves, five of them, and two fishes. Five's the symbol of grace. And Philip knew the numerology. He grew up in that frame. Two is the adequate witness. The numbers themselves should have inspired faith on the part of Andrew, rather. And he comes and says, there's a lad here which have five barley loaves, two small fishes. Oh, for the gift of knowing when to shut your mouth. He could have ended it right there. A hero. We never would have known how small his faith was. Here, Lord. Philip, where do we go buy bread and feed these people? 200 pennyworth wouldn't do it. And another record has the rest of the disciples chime in. Yeah, 200 pennyworth wouldn't do it. Then here comes Andrew, bringing a lad. Here's a lad, Lord, with a basket. Five loaves, two fishes. Oh, for the gift of shutting up. Watch him ruin it. There is a lad here which hath five barley loaves and two small fishes, but what are they among so many? Don't you want to smack him? Don't you really want to lay one on him? You ever deal with, you ever defended a client, Ed, that given a deposition or as a witness, you wish they could just shut up? They say it and then undo it? Huh? Now, you know, you've got the case won. But their mouth, once released, like a spring with much tension on it, must keep dribbling on. There's a lad here with five loaves and two fishes, but what are these among so many? Jesus said, make the men sit down. Now, there was much grass in the place. No humor there. The one recording it must have had a sensitive bottom or something. John must have been grateful for the grass or so, whatever. Make the men sit down. Now, there was much grass in the place. So the men sat down, in number about 5,000. Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed to the disciples, and the disciples to them that were set down, and likewise to the fishes as much as they would. When they were filled, he said unto his disciples, gather up the fragments that remain, that nothing be lost. Therefore they gathered them together and filled 12 baskets with the fragments of the five barley loaves which remained over and above unto them which had eaten. Think of that. 12 baskets left over. You say, you believe that? Well, I sure do. That's easier than the resurrection. I crossed the resurrection hurdle. Is that harder than God supplying you? God giving you the promise, bring you all the tithe into the storehouse. Prove me now herewith, see if there isn't meat in mine house, or that there might be meat in my house, and see that I don't pour you out a blessing you can't contain. God can't do that to you? When he leaves these 12 loaves over? Go to Mark 6. Another version of this. The story starts at verse 34. Jesus, when he came out, saw much people moved with compassion. Went to a desert place. His disciples came unto him and said, "This is a desert place. Now the time is far past, at dinner time. Send them away that they may go into the country round about, into the villages, and buy themselves bread, for they have nothing to eat." He answered and said unto them, "Give ye them to eat." Let's dwell on that one for a minute. Same story. Give ye them to eat. That was the predecessor to Philip. He still hung up on that. I'll bet you that the minute that Jesus said, "Give ye them to eat," Philip's sitting over there saying, "He expects us to feed them?" And then he zeroes in on Philip and says, "Where can you go buy bread? 200 penny worth won't feed these. At one bite apiece." And you come to the 43rd verse, after the same story is told, "They took up 12 baskets full of the fragments and of the fish, and they that did eat of the loaves were about 5,000 men. Straightway he constrained his disciples to get into the ship, go to the other side before unto Bethsaida, while he sent away the people." Now he led them into the desert. He led them into the desert. Proved them there. And multiplied the loaves and fishes. Now he sends them in the storm. I've been telling you for the next 70-some days, 60-some now, as we get ready for the fixed date of moving in downtown, storms are going to hit. Quit thinking that Christianity escapes deserts and storms. Now he's going to send them into a storm. Straightway he constrained his disciples to get into a ship and go to the other side. Well, he sent away the people. He went up the mountain to pray. They got in a boat. When even was come, the ship was in the midst of the sea, he alone on the land. And a great storm hit them. They saw him walking upon the sea, verse 50, were troubled. He said, "Be of good cheer, it's not I, it is I, be not afraid." He went up into them, into the ship, and the wind ceased. Storm ceased. And they were sore amazed in themselves beyond measure and wondered. I want to din this one into you. You've heard it, some of you on festival, others on rerun. This is a message where I expect you to leave here with no doubt in your mind what your choices are. It's not a message where I expect to titillate you with something new because I opened it up on festival 3 days ago. But listen to this verse. "He came in the ship, and the wind ceased, and they were sore amazed in themselves beyond measure, and wondered," what? At what? The next word is "for." That's a Greek word, "dar." It is a rhetorical device. As you study philosophy in this language, in our land, you have what's called a tautology: if this, then that. In the Hebrew rhetorical and the Greek rhetorical frame of the day, this was not just a random word. This was a rhetorical word, or a word of logic, that when you introduce a sentence with that, that which follows this word "for" is going to explain the sentence that went prior to the word "gar" or "for." So it is very clear that they were not amazed beyond measure and wondering that he had ceased the storm. That's what the quick reader is going to think. Quick reader is going to think they're amazed because he calmed the storm. That's not the case. If that were the case, the next verse would say they were amazed and wondered, for he had calmed the storm. Because the word for tells you what they were, that the next words are going to tell you what they were amazed and wondered at. They were not amazed and wondering because he calmed the storm. Hear me closely. They were amazed and wondered at themselves for having doubted for a moment in the storm. For they considered not the miracle of the loaves, for their heart was hardened. These people had just come from the miracle of the loaves and fishes where he had proved them, and no sooner did they get into the next circumstance than immediately they're terrorized. Instead of believing that Jesus, who sent them there, would enable them to go through. One other passage has a sequel put in parentheses, and I got 3 minutes before my hour's up, so hang tight. A parenthesis is in another passage. I admire Peter that it's not in Mark, because Mark, Peter was the source of Mark, and Peter has Mark spend more time talking about his failures than cataloging that he walked on water. But Peter cries out, "If it's you, Lord, say, bid me come." Jesus says, "It's I. Come." He gets out of that boat and starts walking on the water. Now, no matter what is said, he walked on more water than any other man in this world other than Jesus. He got out of the boat. I mean, I admire people who get out of the boat and sink a lot more than those who won't get out of the boat. He got out of the boat. And he walked. And then it says, when he saw the waves and the wind was blowing, he began to sink. And he said, "Lord, save me." And Jesus made a statement. In the New Testament, it's, "O ye of little faith." It's only one word in the Greek. Little faith. It's like colloquial. You know, have you ever... You don't say, "Oh, ye whose head, because of the kinds of thoughts you are expressing, is as empty of creative thoughts as a bean sprout that has been planted and grows from the ground." You say, "Bean head?" You don't say, "Oh, you who are exhibiting the trait as though someone has numbed your head and frozen it for some future resurrection." You say, "Numbskull!" That's what Jesus did. He said, "Little faith!" He gave him a new name. "Oh, little faith! Why did you doubt?" The New King James says, the literal is, "Why did you double think?" "Oh, little faith! Why did you double think? What'd you get out for and step in faith? The wind was blowing before you got out. The waves were rocking before you got out. What'd you get out for, and then when you got out, think twice about it? Pause and look at the circumstance. Instead of going straight on, oh, little faith." He gave him a name. He didn't condemn him for having little faith. "Little faith, why did you double think?" This whole chapter is a sequence on faith. All Philip could do was count pennies and count the crowd and have no faith at all. Andrew had half faith. He could bring the boy, but what is this among so many? Peter, the best he could muster was little faith that would think twice about it. And I feel sorry for myself that I don't get 100% faith out of my congregation.
Considering this, I think I won't commit suicide this afternoon. I'll give it one more try. Do you realize what little faith accomplished? Little faith walked on water. Have you got the message? Are you going to do it? I mean, will you not count pennies the rest of this week? Will you get on the phone today and make your commitment? Will you not say, well, all I can commit is this, but what is this against 300,000? Will you not start and then look at the circumstances and double think? You can't figure this message out. You're hopeless. Now let's start right now. Come on, ushers, and don't get a piano player helping you either. With the bag. Up here is okay. He's not a piano player anyway. He's an engineer who tinkles. Come on, Dad. I'll be looking at you this afternoon.